Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Military History, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Alex Beckstrand, and I'm the host for today's discussion. I'm very delighted to be joined by Jennifer Mittelstadt and Mark Wilson, who are the editors of The Military and the Market. This is newly released just this fall in 2022 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Jennifer is a professor of history at Rutgers University, and Mark is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And I'm very excited to have you both here for the interview. So welcome to Jennifer and Mark.
Thanks for having us, Alex.
You bet. So I wonder if we could just dive right in right away. And for listeners who might be wondering how you might define it, could we just start with how you define the market in and of itself?
I'm going to start and Jennifer can jump in and correct me and add things as well. You know, I think one of the points of the book is to define the market pretty broadly. So often in the literature, people might talk about a specific defense market where the focus is on weapons and traditional hardware contractors. But part of the point of this book is to look at a lot of different kinds of markets for all sorts of goods and services that the military might need. And so for the military, you know, the market is a place outside the military itself where it might go to get the goods and services it needs from private firms. And it's going to be buying them in most cases instead of just impressing it or commanding it. And the market, another way in which we use the term in the book, I think, and Jennifer can talk more about this, is we're also talking about the market as kind of an idea or an ideal in American political and economic thinking. And the military is engaged in thinking about that ideal. It's kind of like an idealized space where you get a lot of efficient outcomes because of competition among firms and prices set by supply and demand. And part of the content of the book describes the military's kind of fascination with the market as an idea. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later.
Yeah, I think that about sums it up. The only thing I would really add to it is, you know, to Mark's point about the way that we wanted to try to define markets broadly, we were really following some of the interesting literature that has emerged in different kinds of histories that we might think of as sort of war and society. And there we found scholars working on the military as, you know, in its relationship to labor markets or its relationship to consumer markets. So even where we are talking about sort of more traditional economic markets, it's, as Mark said, well beyond just production of weapons and materiel, purchasing and acquisition of those. And following that, those new histories was actually one of the really exciting and fun parts of the book.
Yeah, and one other, you know, note I took was the military as well was in many ways more broadly defined than just, or maybe not defined, but investigated than more than just the Army or the Navy. There's a look in one of the chapters at the VA, for example. So you're sort of investigating this trajectory of the military in the market, even after service is complete for service members as well. So I found that interesting also.
Right. I think we wanted to think about how it's not just markets that have to be broadly defined, but we kind of have to disaggregate like what the military is and really think about it in all its respects, not only all the different parts of the institution that, you know, range from the services to the DOD and VA, as you said, but also I think to distinguishing between a focus on kind of wartime or the lead up to war and sort of think about what books about demobilization, what books about militarization and the kind of widespread long-term militarization of U.S. society in the 20th century can tell us about different places and times and ways we might find military-related actors doing interesting things in the realm of the history of the market. So we wanted to kind of gather diverse definitions of both in the book.
Great. And how did you both decide to pursue the topic? Was it independently done and somehow you collaborated, or how did you both come to the topic?
Well, Jennifer and I didn't know one another before 2015 when we got placed on the same panel at a conference out in California. And we had written conference papers related to the book projects we were finishing that were about, you know, kind of the military and the market after World War II, broadly defined. And before we were at this conference, we weren't really aware of one another's work on that, but we produced very similar papers. And then, so this is 2015, so it's been a while, but over the next few years, we tried to find ways to collaborate, co-author something. And eventually we kind of made our way towards putting together this book. But I'm going to let Jennifer continue the story because it was one of her teaching experiences that kind of pushed us further down the road.
Yeah, that's right. Mark and I had probably been working together for about 2 years when I went to spend a year at the U.S. Army War College as the Harold K. Johnson Chair in Military History. And there I was encouraged by some of my colleagues in the Department of National Security Studies to offer an elective course on the military and the market. And though I'd been researching it and talking with Mark a fair amount about it, I'd really never taught anything about it. So actually, using Mark's help and a fair amount of Mark's own published work on the Civil War and afterward, I pulled together a course, and I had officers from, you know, defense acquisitions and contracts, you know, logistics, a JAG officer. We sort of pulled all this material together about the long and diverse history of relationships between the military and the market and tried to think about what we could say about that history, but also what it might mean to military officers themselves looking for lessons from the past. And it was such a fun experience that afterward that summer, I contacted Mark. I said, hey, you know, I found so much new material and you were so crucial in doing this. Plus, we've been working together. What if we turned our joint project into a, you know, really special edited volume that would allow us to pull a bunch of these new pieces of scholarship together? And he was game. So we started off on the project.
Yes. And as you mentioned, you know, this is an edited volume. And so could you just briefly describe some of the chapters in the book?
Yeah, Alex, if you don't mind taking the time, I know we're going to talk about a few of the individual chapters later, but if I may, I'll just very quickly run through the 9 chapters and their authors, because really the best thing about the book is the authors that Jennifer and I got a chance to learn from and collaborate with on the volume. So I'll just, you know, I'll be brief, but your listeners might be interested in, you know, any one of these. And I think any one of them is worth the price of admission for the book. There are 9 different chapters besides the intro and conclusion that we did. Jennifer and I have our own chapter, which is about what we call the privatizations of the military since World War II. There's a chapter by A. June Murphy on Cold War military housing, which I think we'll talk about later. The political scientist Dan Wuerls has a chapter on the evolution of the military-industrial complex in very recent times toward, you know, a kind of bigger complex encompassing the VA and other institutions. Sarah Weichsel has a chapter on the Civil War, which is kind of an ingenious one. I think we'll talk more about that later, about soldier entrepreneurs in the Civil War. Kara Vuick has a chapter on the U.S. military and prostitution across the 20th century. Gretchen Hefner contributed one on the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers, and base building in the Cold War. Patrick Chung has one on a South Korean scientist, Kang Ki-dong, who was active in semiconductor research and was on kind of various sides of the U.S. military-industrial complex and global military-industrial complex. Tim Barker has a chapter on military Keynesianism, focused on the 1970s. And then Jessica Adler has a chapter, which you referenced previously, Alex, on Vietnam War veterans, labor markets, and veteran activism in trying to get the kind of assistance and benefits they deserved. So that's it. Sorry to take the time, but I think your listeners might be interested in one or more of those.
Yeah, and I think just by you going through the chapters, it demonstrates, you know, what we talked about at the beginning, which is how broadly defined the market in the military in some instances could be. And you almost could take this topic in so many different directions, anywhere that there's sort of something to be researched, which was great.
Alex, if I could just jump in, I would say that, you know, you're exactly right. And listening again to that list of chapters reminds me that, you know, one of the things we tried to do, because there were so many possible different directions, was take a lead in kind of developing themes in the literature that was emerging around diverse ways that the military and the market have come together in history. And, you know, I think that the diverse chapters nevertheless coalesce around these three themes. You know, one is the public and private theme, that throughout U.S. history, the military has combined its own public function and reliance on the private sector in various ways at various times. A second is really about how you can't think about the military and the market without thinking about how gender and race intersect with military and market relationships in many different capacities. And we see that in the intimate story of Sarah Jones Weichsel and the soldier entrepreneurship. We see it in the chapter on sex work with Kara Vuick, and also the chapter that you just mentioned with Jessica Adler and the kind of economic returns to military service for African-American veterans after Vietnam. And then also the final theme really that we see in the chapters is that there's a real powerful global history of military market relationships in the U.S. military that there's a lot more to be done on that, but it really shows the impact, I think, of both foreign markets and the U.S. military and its expansion across the globe, particularly in the period since World War II.
Yeah, and if we could dive in to talk a little bit about some of the content, first with your collective chapter, can you talk about some of the historical trends of military privatizations, and, you know, maybe start off with what you mean by that, and then talk about the trends that you see?
Sure. I'm sure we'll both talk about this. So here we're talking about the chapter Jennifer and I contributed, and again, that actually came out of our multi-year effort to co-author something on this subject. What we describe in our chapter is a very long-run story of change over time, where the U.S. military goes from being one in which the military itself does a lot of its own production of goods and services. And it's a kind of multi-competent, big government-style military, as we describe it. And that military fades over time. And so part of the history that we offer in our chapter is one of a decline of that kind of big military towards one that relies more on contractors, that's outsourced more of its activities and has shed a lot of its former capacities to a kind of leaner, more privatized military. I know your listeners are probably familiar with certain aspects of that, including, you know, the security firms like Blackwater that became active in recent years. But we describe a kind of very long run process there.
Yeah, I would just jump in and add that it's probably that last point from my point of view that was a jumping off point, is that I sort of knew when I began thinking about these military market relationships that there was a purportedly sudden and drastic turn towards military privatization with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there were several good works that came out in that period describing the use of private military contractors like Blackwater. But trying to look at the long roots of that, and also trying to denaturalize that story and put it in a wider context, really became the goal of our joint efforts. And one of the things that we realized was that it was not at all inevitable. And it was not at all the result of political efforts that only took place in like the early aughts, you know, in the 2000s with the war. It was a political choice, a concerted political effort made by opponents of the New Deal state. So the story took us all the way back to the 30s and then the 1940s, where we discovered free market, free enterprise, business people and their allies in Congress who were really trying to kind of use what had become a large government apparatus, both of the New Deal and World War II, as a kind of new market for themselves, where the post-war private sector was looking for new ways to expand and make profits. And they basically argued that the government should hand over some of its government functions to corporations to do that work. And so we tell the story of how that occurred, how the pressure from political lobbying took place. And then we kind of trace a sort of ultimately successful, but still uneven story about how the contracting out or the outsourcing and the privatization took place from, you know, weapons and materiel factories through real estate and then eventually into military services much later.
Yeah, and I was thinking a little bit, actually, I was thinking a little bit last night because I was doing a little bit of my own research for my own kind of project. And I'm looking at the World War I era. And so I was looking at the National Defense Act of 1916. And there's sort of discussions about, for example, putting a rider in that bill to have the government take control of and own a nitrate plant for helping to obviously make explosives. And so I sort of struck me as connected to your chapter a little bit, and that there sort of seems to be periods where there's sort of an increased trend toward greater government control. And then maybe that's followed by or somehow related to a trend also towards greater privatization. And I sort of see both, you know, almost in the story there. So could you maybe talk about that and why both might be prevalent or important?
I think that's right, Alex, and certainly true over the long run. We've seen both. You know, part of our argument is that there's been a discernible shift in one direction in particular since World War II. But of course, if you break it down and look at the micro level, there's a lot of complexity going on all the time. And Jennifer's work which I think we'll discuss eventually, has shown that really nicely for the later 20th century. But one thing that your question, I think, suggests is, you know, we need to think about kind of the political side of this. And it is true, I think, as you're suggesting quite rightly, that there was something about, you know, there's something about kind of progressive and populist political moments where you might see even more interest in having the military perhaps avoid markets or avoid contracting more than you might expect. And so, you know, certain legislators or even certain military officers themselves may be kind of suspicious of, you know, industrial corporations at certain moments in American political history more than they might be at other times. So I think it's absolutely right. Yeah, there are a little bit, there's some kind of cyclical action along with this, I think what we argue is this kind of key watershed moment in the Cold War as well.
Absolutely. So if we could also talk about a few of the other chapters as well, would you be able to maybe kind of offer what insight you could on Ajun Murphy's chapter about military housing in the Cold War era? And I found it interesting, you know, using the term landlord and how the military became so robust at its landlord efforts during the Cold War.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this chapter. I think what I love about the chapter is having authored a book on the military and its function as a welfare state. Here we see another dimension to it that I did not cover in my book, and I'm really excited to learn about it. And it's, as you said, the role of the military, perhaps unexpected, in creating a kind of really large collection of housing across the country, really, and sometimes in other places around the world, though Murphy focuses really on the U.S. And what's interesting about this is that it allows Murphy and for readers to see that there really is this public-private combination. You know, what the military is doing in this period is trying to see how fast it can get these much-needed housing tracts built for its large Cold War and now married with families military. And it's trying to do it by offering the work out to the private sector, finding, however, that there is criticism about windfall profits. There are poor contracts that sort of give too much to the private sector builders. And then kind of bringing some of that back in-house with the military taking over the management of some of this. And in the process, it brings the military into a kind of really intimate involvement with the rest of what's going on in American society in the Cold War period, which is the building of these huge suburbs. And so the military becomes part, really, of the kind of social reproduction, is what Murphy calls it, of American families and society in the Cold War, by producing these suburbs and kind of bringing a suburban lifestyle into the U.S. military. I think for me, it's a great story of the public and private, but also the way that the military is trying to negotiate, you know, racial integration, how it envisions nuclear families and how they should live. It's a really insightful chapter that I think could be a use to anyone who's looking at urban history, post-war history, and of course, military history.
And then another one of the chapters, Sarah Jones Weeksill's edition on Civil War consumer culture. As far as I remember, I think that might be the only one that is centered, at least in the prior to the 20th century, which also makes it, you know, unique in and of itself. Could you also maybe talk about that and how that fits into the rest of the discussion, this chapter?
Yeah, let me talk for a minute about that one, Alex. In part, I want to talk because that I got my own start thinking about these issues, thinking about the 19th century and the Civil War era. So this is Sarah Weichsel's chapter, and she makes incredible use of a set of papers of William and Nancy Willoughby. And William was a soldier with the, I think that's the Connecticut's 10th Infantry Regiment in the Civil War. And he, with his unit, he was down fighting the Civil War in the Southeast. But this is a story of entrepreneurship by individual soldier and also by a kind of family unit, because this married couple worked together very closely to manage to sell all sorts of goods like clothing and writing instruments and paper and other assorted goods to the soldiers in William's unit. So it's a story of a, you know, individual entrepreneur. He's noticing that his fellow soldiers want stuff that's not being provided by the army itself, by the sutlers who may be nearby selling things from their wagons, by the many nonprofit groups that aided the soldiers, like the Sanitary Commission and Christian Commission. William and his fellow kind of soldier entrepreneurs saw a kind of niche for themselves in which they could make some money. And what William did is he got Nancy to make and buy stuff back at home in Connecticut, ship it via express services to him, and sell it to his fellow soldiers. It's just kind of this fascinating story. And it fits with some of the other chapters in our book where entrepreneurship by individuals is also kind of a big part of the story, like Patrick's Chung chapter on Dr. Kang, and also certainly Kara Vuick's chapter on sex markets as well.
Yeah, very, very interesting and amusing. And that's a good segue into maybe talking about Kara Vuick's chapter on military and prostitution. And I should say that's, excuse me, that's lumped, I think, into the larger trajectory of your book, where again it's broadening the discussion. There's a chapter on race and benefits, the chapter regarding Cold War military housing, you know, incorporates gender norms into that chapter as well, and into the discussion. But Kara Dixon Vuick's chapter on military and the prostitution, that might seems surprising to some. So I'm curious if you could talk about how the military saw the market of sex work in the 20th century.
Well, Alex, I actually have a hard time believing that sex work in the military would actually come as a surprise to anyone who studies it.
That's true.
Or who's been in it. But that aside, you're right that it's usually, I mean, it is not put front and center in discussions of the military and the market, much less in most kind of formal discussions about the military. So I think what Kara Vuick is doing is recovering this area where we know there has been a tremendous amount of both labor and payment for the labor, a market that we know has been regulated in various ways by the military, and trying to bring it to light and understand it as an essential economic activity for militaries. Really, you know, we could probably say this for the world over and throughout time, but certainly for the U.S. military and the 20th century. The military's treatment of it, she shows, has changed over time. But it is clear that it always considered sex work as something essential that would be present, and that the essentialness was really about keeping up morale. It was almost like a consumer market for the morale of service personnel. And what she shows is that they played fairly direct roles in various times and places, both outside the U.S. and within the U.S., in regulating it over time, you know, all the way up through, I think, probably the most famous example which is in Hawaii during World War II, when he or she draws on the scholarship of military historian Beth Bailey and her husband David Farber, and they show how the military, you know, set prices, hours, all kinds of things for the brothels in Honolulu at that time. But then, you know, Vuick shows how the period afterward resulted in a kind of turning away from open regulation of sex work, sort of pressing it to the margins, even as it continued, and even as some what we might call soldier entrepreneurs, you know, leaders of various units, went ahead and had to regulate it during places and times when they were overseas, or even within the U.S. They kind of pressed it down to the unit level to be handed. In a way, handled, I think, it, you know, in a way it sort of turns into a kind of more, I don't want to say I mean, it's more of a black market function. It's not as open, but it's still there and the regulation is still there. I think part of what Vuick is trying to say too is that, you know, there's real questions now about what's going on with sex work and the military. It's, you know, now so officially frowned upon, as I said, pushed to the side, but it's still occurring. And, you know, she ends with this most remarkable story here within the United States. Gosh, it's not at Fort Leonard Wood. I can't remember if it's there or it's at one of the posts in Texas, where it turns out that, you know, that some officer in charge of training is actually roping in his own female recruits into paid sex work. So it's a complicated story about the military and sex work, but I think such an important and common one that it's necessary to include it in a broad treatment of the military and the market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wonder if we could kind of digress a little bit from talk about the chapters and maybe just hear about the grueling process of sort of compiling and working on the project itself. So how did you end up going through the various papers that were submitted, and was there a conference that was held initially to get this project going?
I'll start talking about it and Jennifer can add on. We never did a lot of these volumes, as Alex is suggesting, come out of conferences, and this one did not. As we were suggesting earlier, you know, Jennifer and I met back in 2015. We wanted to find a way to collaborate. And then after she taught her war college course, we started to move in the direction of thinking about an edited volume. But we didn't do a conference, I suppose, in part because we didn't, neither of us, as far as I know, didn't have access to huge amounts of money to do that. And we wanted to move kind of fast, I think, and wanted to kind of just get a move on with it. So we brainstormed a lot, and we also reached out to a lot of colleagues, and we also did just a lot of cold new, you know, digging to try to figure out which scholars might be doing really interesting new work in this area. And we came up with long lists of possibilities and tried to have a really diverse range of scholars and topics represented. And then eventually, you know, the nine chapters that we ended up with represent only a kind of a small set of what we were kind of thinking about in the beginning. But I'll let Jennifer jump in and add to that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this is one of those volumes that I think that doesn't represent the culmination of a kind of known field, but rather stakes out territories of work being done by scholars who themselves actually might not define them, you know, their work as military market scholarship, but that we, in kind of trying to pull together a sort of syllabus of what's happening now, saw as such. So some of our historians considered themselves, I think, like labor historians. Some of them thought of themselves as historians of, you know, the welfare state. Some people thought of themselves as historians of capitalism. Some of them thought of themselves as historians of US and the world. And we sort of said to them, we think you're historians of the military and the market in representative of the really interesting ways that people are defining markets and the military in recent years. You know, would you like to have this conversation? And we were so lucky to get so many interesting people who said, you're right, I didn't think of myself necessarily that way. Yeah, how would that be? And it, what it did was make the editing process really enjoyable. We were able to have great conversations with the individual authors as we sort of thought together about how we could make their empirical research, their original research, sort of speak really directly to some of these questions. And, you know, I think Mark would probably say the same thing. It was pretty effortless in putting it together. I mean, even with the pandemic, really the authors kind of miraculously didn't miss a beat in getting the work done. And, you know, everyone should be so lucky to write a book with Mark Wilson. I mean, like the essence of chill, but also able to get everything done on time. We had already been working together writing, and so we had established a kind of no egos zone where, you know, he could put up with my very poorly written rough drafts, and I wouldn't be offended when he corrected things and things like that. So we really just cut the work down the middle then, once we had these amazing authors, passed it back and forth and got it done. And we too were lucky to sort of have had that in place before the pandemic hit. So we kind of had these habits and structures of work to rely on that made it really smooth and enjoyable.
Well, I'll just interject and say right back at you, Jennifer, because Jennifer's such a joy to work with. And I think we really benefited from kind of having similar sensibilities about, you know, getting stuff done promptly and, providing constructive criticism to the authors and being flexible enough to work with them. So it was a real joy to work with Jennifer. And we did get it done pretty fast. And you know, a lot of this, Alex, of course, was a lot of the certainly the revisions and the editing was done during the COVID crisis, and that made things a little bit challenging, but we got it done. And University of Pennsylvania Press and our acquisitions editor, Bob Lockhart, helped out a lot. So it turned out to be, as Jennifer suggested, maybe easier than we expected to pull it off.
A few more questions I have for you, just contextually with the book. Do you, in particular with your chapter, your collective chapter, do you see concerning, sort of concerning markers with the Cold War and post-Cold War trends regarding privatization in the military?
I'll jump in on this, though. Really, Mark, you know, he's working on a new project now that's bringing him right up to the present. And yeah, I think is probably one of the best experts we have now in the U.S. on this. So I can just sort of give my slightly older and less informed take on it and then turn it over to Mark. But yes, I do find concerning the growing privatization of the military. And when I was teaching that class, I actually found that many of the officers I was teaching found it a little bit concerning too. I think, you know, the privatization of not really just, you know, weapons and materiel and real estate, but also kind of every range of what the military defines as services, right? But that can mean everything from writing reports to providing healthcare to providing, psychological care to recreation, right? It can mean a wide range of things when we talk about services, but the kind of full scale outsourcing and privatization of this, I think raises for me real questions about, what do I want to call it, responsibility, I guess, and capacity in an institution that is supposed to have real clear lines of responsibility and have a pretty robust capacity. So, you know, I think some of the questions that we talked about in class and that we talk about here in the epilogue to the book is kind of like, what does it mean for an institution, you know, from my point of view, taking military services and welfare services into account, you know, what does it mean that an institution that values cohesion and loyalty, taking care of its own, to hand that work off to contractors when it had been built up and in-house in the 70s and 1980s? What does it mean to tell families to be sort of self-reliant in figuring out how to call the private firm when they have a problem with flooding in their housing or mold or pollution on post? What does it mean when a post commander herself or himself has to get in the helpline on the corporate queue to get an answer for a problem from a private corporation? I think, you know, there are real questions here about responsibility and military effectiveness that are raised by privatization and outsourcing, and, you know, questions that are not purely economic. But even to go to the economic, I would say the part of the thing that I see as concerning is that, from what I could tell, and I am not an expert in contracts, but it also seemed like many of the contracts were, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, not good. They favor private interests greatly, often forcing the government to pay actually more than it should over the long term in various ways. And of course, they're quite devoid of democratic oversight. You know, they're private, and it's not clear what's happening in some of these contracts and why. And so I think that too is a kind of citizen state democracy problem that is of no small concern.
I think that's very well said by Jennifer. I'll just add a handful of things. Maybe, you know, what do we have to contribute to this discussion as historians, you know, in particular, because of course, so many people are interested in these issues who have a lot of experience and knowledge about it. And there's a lot of disagreement, I think, Alex, as you probably would point out, about whether the outsourcing is good or bad, and about its costs and benefits. And of course, it's a, you know, it's a complex situation, and it's not black and white. Of course, there still is some in-house capacity, and there's always been contractors and so forth. So it is complicated, and there's a lot of room for disagreement. I think one of the things that Jennifer and I are suggesting as historians is that people in the present day who may, you know, even mid-career officers, right, they may have been born in the 1980s, right, if they can kind of open their eyes to past practices, they might actually be surprised that what today seems like just obvious facts or indisputable ways of thinking about government and business, for example. In fact, at certain points in the past, those things have not been understood as so obvious. And I think so, just as a, you know, this volume is largely a volume offered by historians. And I think, you know, as historians, sometimes we don't have much to say to the military, but in this case, I think we really do. And as Jennifer put it so well, it's really important for the military to kind of step back and maybe denaturalize some of their practices and some of their ways of thinking when it comes to the military and the market.
Yeah, and I wonder as well, even though, you know, as historians, you know, you may, sometimes it's, you know, not, it's, it might be a little concerning sometimes to start thinking about the future and what that might hold. But do you see any, again, we talk a lot about trends of the military and the market over the course of the conversation. Do you see any trends for the military and the market in the future? Are there mechanisms in place to help maybe adapt or adjust from the current state of relations between the military and the market?
You know, I think Mark might be the best person to answer this, but I would just almost take your question, Alex, and just remind us of Dan Worles' chapter in our book, which underscores the point that it's not just the military that has undergone since World War II and really important and significant privatization and outsourcing, but in fact, quite a lot of what Dan Worles calls the national security contracting complex, right? That includes, you know, new things that weren't in, you know, around after World War II, like the Department of Homeland Security, right? But Department of Energy, NASA, right? All this process of privatization has occurred across government sectors broadly in national security, and of course, even beyond national security. So your question is really important about what the future might hold, because it's something that's important for the military and also the kind of entire spectrum of government function. But Mark knows, Mark maybe knows more with his current research about thinking about whether or not this is a trend that sort of feels inevitable, or whether or not, you know, what our history is telling us is like certain things could happen to call into question the kind of current regime that we see in outsourcing in the military.
Yeah, though, Alex, as Jennifer and I start to talk about, and even in the conclusion to the book, which we wrote a little while ago, even some kind of recent developments like the COVID crisis and the obsession in Washington today of thinking about China as a great power rival, for example, some of those things have, I think, led to some questioning of current practices. I think, and I think Jennifer and I agree on this, it's hard to imagine a radical departure from the current enthusiasm for contracting in the near term. It just seems like the accumulation of institutions and practices and habits and ways of thinking that have grown up over the last few decades is quite powerful. So it's hard to imagine a kind of radical departure from that across the board. But certainly in specific areas, you know, there may be important changes in the short term. And then, of course, as you know, Alex, as a student of history, I mean, we never are able to anticipate the next giant crisis, but we know one may come. And so it is possible to imagine like a major military defeat for the United States or some other, you know, immense development that we can't anticipate, but that could well happen. There, you know, at those kind of moments in time, you can get revolutionary change, right? And we know that from our study of the past. So one never knows. But I think Jennifer and I agree in the short term, barring some massive new crisis, we're still more or less in the moment that we described in our chapter.
Well, you both have certainly given myself and I'm sure the readers a lot to think about, as well as all the contributors of the edited volume that we've been talking about. I will commit the great sin of asking as a final question, if there for authors who have just finished and just recently published an edited volume, if you also have any other projects that are in the works that you'd like to discuss. And I know we've alluded to Mark's current work or that he's working on as well. But would you like to provide some information about those?
Well, I'll go first because my current project doesn't have anything to do with the military and the market, which is a surprise to me. It's a look at grassroots involvement in U.S. foreign policy on the right. And actually, when I began it, I was starting sort of with a history I knew fairly well, which was the Contra War. And I thought there would be more military and market involvement. But as so often happens with history, I now found myself back in the time of World War I with a whole different cast of characters. And I would say I'm as much in the realm of religious and cultural history, more there than military markets and society. But Mark is, hard at work on what I think of as probably the, you know, most important long-term project on the military and the market that's in the works right now. So I'll hand it over to Mark.
I've been working for a few years now and trying to find a way to write a book about the history of the U.S. military industrial complex, you know, or another way of putting it, the kind of history of business and politics in the U.S. defense sector. from the 1950s to the present. So for me, that's a big challenge because it's a big chunk of time, whereas in my earlier works, I focused on more specific wars. But it's been a great rewarding challenge for me. I've got the benefit of a generous grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York this year and next year to help me make some progress on it. And so I'm hoping I can offer up a one-volume history of the military-industrial complex. I think there's room for something there, Alex. You may, I don't know if you agree, but the military-industrial complex is a subject that tends to generate a lot of extreme emotion on one side or another. And we've got a lot of incredible work, you know, on different parts of it. And we've got a lot of enthusiastic work by various people. But I think there's still room to kind of offer a broad new history that it would offer maybe a new way of thinking about it. So that's my effort right now.
Well, both of those projects sound fantastic. And we would love to have you back on the New Books Network to discuss them. Once they are complete. this has been a pleasure and a delight for both Jennifer and Mark to have both of you on here discussing the edited volume of The Military and the Market. University of Pennsylvania Press, 2022, just released this fall. And thank you very much for your time and the wonderful discussion and insights.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Alex. We really enjoyed it.